until it had rounded the corner and the unpaved street's easily airborne dust had landed again. She was still contemplating the view when Bobby, shadowed by his large little brother, became a part of it. A wobbly figure headed her way. She went out on the porch to meet him. She said, "I wanted so much to tell you." Bobby began to cry. Larry lingered at the edge of the Teacheridge yard, hunched against a tree. He couldn't remember ever seeing Bobby cry, and he didn't want to, so he lowered his eyes. Far off, in the town of Olathe, in a hotel room where window shades darkened the midday sun, Perry lay sleeping, with a gray portable radio murmuring beside him. Except for taking off his boots, he had not troubled to undress. He had merely fallen face down across the bed, as though sleep were a weapon that had struck him from behind. The boots, black and silver buckled, were soaking in a wash basin filled with warm, vaguely pink-tinted water. A few miles north, in the pleasant kitchen of a modest farmhouse, Dick was consuming a Sunday dinner. The others at the table, his mother, his father, his younger brother, were not conscious of anything uncommon in his manner. He had arrived home at noon, kissed his mother, readily replied to questions his father put concerning his supposed overnight trip to Fort Scott, and sat down to eat, seeming quite his ordinary self. When the meal was over, the three male members of the family settled in the parlor to watch a televised basketball game. The broadcast had only begun when the father was startled to hear Dick snoring. As he remarked to the younger boy, he never thought he'd live to see the day when Dick would rather sleep than watch basketball. But of course he did not understand how very tired Dick was. Did not know that his dozing son had, among other things, driven over 800 miles in the past 24 hours. Part 2. Persons Unknown. That Monday, the 16th of November, 1959, was still another fine specimen of pheasant weather on the high wheat plains of western Kansas. A day gloriously bright-skied, as glittery as mica. Often, on such days in years past, Andy Earhart had spent long pheasant-hunting afternoons at River Valley Farm, the home of his good friend Herb Clutter, and often, on these sporting expeditions, he'd been accompanied by three more of Herb's closest friends. Dr. J. E. Dale, a veterinarian, Carl Myers, a dairy owner, and Everett Ogburn, a businessman. Like Earhart, the superintendent of the Kansas State University Agricultural Experiment Station, all were prominent citizens of Garden City. Today, this quartet of old hunting companions had once again gathered to make the familiar journey, but in an unfamiliar spirit and armed with odd, non-sportive equipment. Mops and pails, scrubbing brushes, and a hamper heaped with rags and strong detergents. They were wearing their oldest clothes. For, feeling it their duty, a Christian task, these men had volunteered to clean certain of the 14 rooms in the main house at River Valley Farm, rooms in which four members of the Clutter family had been murdered by, as their death certificates declared, a person or persons unknown. Earhart and his partners drove in silence. One of them later remarked, "It just shut you up. The strangeness of it. Going out there where we'd always had such a welcome." On the present occasion, a highway patrolman welcomed them. The patrolman, guardian of a barricade that the authorities had erected at the entrance to the farm, waved them on, and they drove a half mile more down the elm-shaded lane leading to the Clutter house. Alfred Stokeline, the only employee who actually lived on the property, was waiting to admit them. They went first to the furnace room in the basement, where the pajama-clad Mr. Clutter had been found sprawled atop the cardboard mattress box. Finishing there, they moved on to the playroom in which Kenyon had been shot to death. The couch, a relic that Kenyon had rescued and mended and that Nancy had slip-covered and piled with mottoed pillows, was a blood-splashed ruin. Like the mattress box, it would have to be burned. Gradually, as the cleaning party progressed from the basement to the second-floor bedrooms where Nancy and her mother had been murdered in their beds, They acquired additional fuel for the impending fire. Blood-soiled bedclothes, mattresses, a bedside rug, a teddy bear doll. Alfred Stokeline, not usually a talkative man, had much to say as he fetched hot water and otherwise assisted in the cleaning up. He wished folks would stop yapping and try to understand why he and his wife, though they lived scarcely 100 yards from the clutter home, had heard nary a nothing, not the slightest echo of gun thunder, of the violence taking place. "Sheriff and all them fellas been out here fingerprinting and scratching around. They got good sense. They understand how it was. How come we didn't hear? For one thing, the wind. A west wind, like it was, would carry the sound the other way. Another thing, there's that big Milo barn tween this house and ourn. That old barn would soak up a lot of racket before it reached us. And did you ever think of this? Him that done it, he must have knowed we wouldn't hear. Else he wouldn't have took the chance, shooting off a shotgun 4 times in the middle of the night. Why, he'd be crazy. Of course, you might say he must be crazy anyhow, to go doing what he did. But my opinion, him that done it had figured it out to the final T. He knowed. And there's one thing I know, too. Me and the missus, we've slept our last night on this place. We're moving to a house alongside the highway. The men worked from noon to dusk. When the time came to burn what they had collected, they piled it on a pickup truck and, with Stokeline at the wheel, drove deep into the farm's north field, a flat place full of color, though a single color, the shimmering tawny yellow of November wheat stubble. There they unloaded the truck and made a pyramid of Nancy's pillows, the bedclothes, the mattresses, the playroom couch. Stokeline sprinkled it with kerosene and struck a match. Of those present, none had been closer to the Clutter family than Andy Earhart. Gentle, genially dignified, a scholar with work-calloused hands and sunburned neck, he'd been a classmate of Herb's at Kansas State University. "We were friends for 30 years, he said some time afterward, and during those decades Earhart had seen his friend evolve from a poorly paid county agricultural agent into one of the region's most widely known and respected farm ranchers. Everything Herb had, he earned, with the help of God. He was a modest man, but a proud man, as he had a right to be. He raised a fine family. He made something of his life. But that life, and what he'd made of it. How could it happen, Earhart wondered as he watched the bonfire catch. How was it possible that such effort, such plain virtue, could overnight be reduced to this? Smoke, thinning as it rose and was received by the big, annihilating sky. The Kansas Bureau of Investigation, a statewide organization with headquarters in Topeka, had a staff of 19 experienced detectives scattered through the state, and the services of these men are available whenever a case seems beyond the competence of local authorities. The Bureau's Garden City representative, and the agent responsible for a sizable portion of western Kansas, is a lean and handsome fourth-generation Kansan of 47 named Alvin Adams Dewey. It was inevitable that Earl Robinson, the sheriff of Finney County, should ask Al Dewey to take charge of the Clutter case. Inevitable and appropriate. For Dewey, himself a former sheriff of Finney County, from 1947 to 1955, and prior to that, a special agent of the FBI, between 1940 and 1945, he had served in New Orleans, in San Antonio, in Denver, in Miami, and in San Francisco, was professionally qualified to cope with even as intricate an affair as the apparently motiveless, all but clueless Clutter murders. Moreover, his attitude toward the crime made it, as he later said, a personal proposition. He went on to say that he and his wife were real fond of Herb and Bonnie, and saw them every Sunday at church, visited a lot back and forth, adding, "But even if I hadn't known the family and liked them so well, I wouldn't feel any different. Because I've seen some bad things. I sure as hell have. But nothing so vicious as this. However long it takes, it may be the rest of my life, I'm going to know what happened in that house. The why and the who. Toward the end, a total of 18 men were assigned to the case full-time. Among them, 3 of the KBI's ablest investigators. Special Agents Harold Nye, Roy Church, and Clarence Dunce. With the arrival in Garden City of this trio, Dewey was satisfied that a strong team had been assembled. "Somebody better watch out," he said. The sheriff's office is on the 3rd floor of the Finney County Courthouse, an ordinary stone and cement building standing in the center of an otherwise attractive tree-filled square. Nowadays, Garden City, which was once a rather raucous frontier town, is quite subdued. On the whole, the sheriff doesn't do much business, and his office, 3 sparsely furnished rooms, is ordinarily a quiet place popular with courthouse idlers. Mrs. Edna Richardson, his hospitable secretary, usually has a pot of coffee going and plenty of time to chew the fat. Or did, until, as she complained, this clutter thing came along, bringing with it all these out-of-towners, all this newspaper fuss. The case, then commanding headlines as far east as Chicago, as far west as Denver, had indeed lured to Garden City a considerable press corps. On Monday, at midday, Dewey held a press conference in the sheriff's office. "I'll talk facts, but not theories," he informed the assembled journalists. "Now the big fact here, the thing to remember, is we're not dealing with 1 murder, but 4. And we don't know which of the 4 was the main target, the primary victim. It could have been Nancy or Kenyon, or either of the parents. Some people say, well, it must have been Mr. Clutter, because his throat was cut. He was the most abused. But that's theory, not fact. It would help if we knew in what order the family died, but the coroner can't tell us that. He only knows the murders happened sometime between 11 p.m. Saturday and 2 a.m. Sunday." Then, responding to questions, he said no, neither of the women had been sexually molested. And no, as far as was presently known, nothing had been stolen from the house. And yes, he did think it a queer coincidence that Mr. Clutter should have taken out a $40,000 life insurance policy with double indemnity within 8 hours of his death. However, Dewey was pretty darn sure that no connection existed between this purchase and the crime. How could there be one, when the only persons who benefited financially were Mr. Clutter's 2 surviving children, the elder daughters, Mrs. Donald Jarchow and Miss Beverly Clutter? And yes, he told the reporters, he did have an opinion on whether the murders were the work of 1 man or 2, but he preferred not to disclose it. Actually, at this time, on this subject, Dewey was undecided. He still entertained a pair of opinions, or to use his word, concepts, and in reconstructing the crime had developed both a single killer concept and a double killer concept. In the former, the murderer was thought to be a friend of the family, or at any rate, a man with more than casual knowledge of the house and its inhabitants. Someone who knew that the doors were seldom locked, that Mr. Clutter slept alone in the master bedroom on the ground floor, that Mrs. Clutter and the children occupied separate bedrooms on the 2nd floor. This person, so Dewey imagined, approached the house on foot, probably around midnight. The windows were dark, the Clutters asleep, and as for Teddy, the farm's watchdog, well, Teddy was famously gun-shy. He would have cringed at the sight of the intruder's weapon, whimpered, and crept away. On entering the house, the killer first disposed of the telephone installations, one in Mr. Clutter's office, the other in the kitchen. And then, after cutting the wires, he went to Mr. Clutter's bedroom and awakened him. Mr. Clutter, at the mercy of the gun-bearing visitor, was forced to obey instructions, forced to accompany him to the 2nd floor where they aroused the rest of the family. Then, with cord and adhesive tape supplied by the killer, Mr. Clutter bound and gagged his wife, bound his daughter, who inexplicably had not been gagged, and roped them to their beds. Next, father and son were escorted to the basement, and there Mr. Clutter was made to tape Kenyon and tie him to the playroom couch. Then Mr. Clutter was taken into the furnace room, hit on the head, gagged, and trussed. Now free to do as he pleased, the murderer killed them one by one, each time carefully collecting the discharged shell. When he had finished, he turned out all the lights and left. It might have happened that way. It was just possible. But Dewey had doubts. If Herb had thought his family was in danger, mortal danger, he would have fought like a tiger. And Herb was no ninny. A strong guy in top condition. Kenyon, too. Big as his dad. Bigger. A big-shouldered boy. It's hard to see how one man, armed or not, could have handled the two of them. Moreover, there was reason to suppose that all four had been bound by the same person. In all four instances, the same type of knot, a half-hitch, was used. Dewey, and the majority of his colleagues as well, favored the second hypothesis, which in many essentials followed the first, the important difference being that the killer was not alone, but had an accomplice, who helped subdue the family, tape, and tie them. Still, as a theory, this too had its faults. Dewey, for example, found it difficult to understand how two individuals could reach the same degree of rage, the kind of psychopathic rage it took to commit such a crime. He went on to explain, assuming the murderer was someone known to the family, a member of this community, assuming that he was an ordinary man, ordinary except that he had a quirk, an insane grudge against the Clutters, or one of the Clutters, where did he find a partner? Someone crazy enough to help him? It doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. But then, come right down to it, nothing does. After the news conference, Dewey retired to his office, a room that the sheriff had temporarily lent him. It contained a desk and two straight chairs. The desk was littered with what Dewey hoped would someday constitute courtroom exhibits. The adhesive tape and the yards of cord removed from the victims and now sealed in plastic sacks. As clues, neither item seemed very promising, for both were common brand products, obtainable anywhere in the United States. And photographs taken at the scene of the crime by a police photographer. 20 blown-up glossy print pictures of Mr. Clutter's shattered skull, his son's demolished face, Nancy's bound hands, her mother's death-dulled, still-staring eyes, and so on. In days to come, Dewey was to spend many hours examining these photographs, hoping that he might suddenly see something, that a meaningful detail would declare itself. Like those puzzles. The ones that ask, how many animals can you find in this picture? In a way, that's what I'm trying to do. Find the hidden animals. I feel they must be there. If only I could see them. As a matter of fact, one of the photographs, a close-up of Mr. Clutter and the mattress box upon which he lay, had already provided a valuable surprise. Footprints. The dusty trackings of shoes with diamond-patterned soles. The prints, not noticeable to the naked eye, registered on film. Indeed, the delineating glare of a flashbulb had revealed their presence with superb exactness. These prints, together with another footmark found on the same cardboard cover, the bold and bloody impression of a cat's paw half-sole, were the only serious clues the investigators could claim. Not that they were claiming them. Dewey and his team had decided to keep secret the existence of this evidence. Among the other articles on Dewey's desk was Nancy Clutter's diary. He had glanced through it, no more than that, and now he settled down to an earnest reading of the day-by-day entries, which began on her 13th birthday and ended some 2 months short of her 17th. The unsensational confidings of an intelligent child who adored animals, who liked to read, cook, sew, dance, ride horseback. A popular, pretty, virginal girl who thought it fun to flirt, but was nevertheless only really and truly in love with Bobby. Dewey read the final entry first. It consisted of three lines written an hour or two before she died. Jolene Kay came over and I showed her how to make a cherry pie. Practiced with Roxy. Bobby here and we watched TV. left at 11. Young Rupp, the last person known to have seen the family alive, had already undergone one extensive interrogation, and although he'd told a straightforward story of having passed just an ordinary evening with the Clutters, he was scheduled for a second interview, at which time he was to be given a polygraph test. The plain fact was that the police were not quite ready to dismiss him as a suspect. Dewey himself did not believe the boy had anything to do with it. Still, it was true that at this early stage of the investigation, Bobby was the only person to whom a motive, however feeble, could be attributed. Here and there in the diary, Nancy referred to the situation that was supposed to have created the motive. Her father's insistence that she and Bobby break off, stop seeing so much of each other. His objection being that the Clutters were Methodist, the Rupps, Catholic. A circumstance that, in his view, completely canceled any hope the young couple might have of one day marrying. But the diary notation that most tantalized Dewey was unrelated to the Clutter-Rupp-Methodist-Catholic impasse. Rather, it concerned a cat, the mysterious demise of Nancy's favorite pet, Boobs, whom, according to an entry dated 2 weeks prior to her own death, she'd found lying in the barn, the victim, or so she suspected, without saying why, of a poisoner. Poor Boobs. I buried him in a special place. On reading this, Dewey felt it could be very important. If the cat had been poisoned, might not this act have been a small, malicious prelude to the murders? He determined to find the special place where Nancy had buried her pet, even though it meant combing the vast whole of River Valley Farm. While Dewey was occupying himself with the diary, his principal assistants, the agents Church, Dunce, and Nye, were crisscrossing the countryside, talking, as Dunce said, to anyone who could tell us anything. The faculty of the Holcomb School, where both Nancy and Kenyon had been honor roll, straight-A students, the employees of River Valley Farm, a staff that in spring and summer sometimes amounted to as many as 18 men, but in the present fallow season consisted of Gerald Van Vliet and 3 hired men, plus Mrs. Helm. Friends of the victims, their neighbors, and very particularly, their relatives. From far and near, some 20 of the last had arrived to attend the funeral services, which were to take place Wednesday morning. The youngest of the KBI group, Harold Nye, who was a peppy little man of 34 with restless, distrustful eyes and a sharp nose, chin, and mind, had been assigned what he called the damn delicate business of interviewing the Clutter kinfolk. It's painful for you, and it's painful for them. When it comes to murder, you can't respect grief, or privacy, or personal feelings. You've got to ask the questions, and some of them cut deep. But none of the persons he questioned, and none of the questions he asked. I was exploring the emotional background. I thought the answer might be another woman. A triangle. Well, consider. Mr. Clutter was a fairly young, very healthy man, but his wife, she was a semi-invalid. She slept in a separate bedroom. Produced useful information. Not even the 2 surviving daughters could suggest a cause for the crime. In brief, Nye learned only this. Of all the people in all the world, the Clutters were the least likely to be murdered. At the end of the day, when the 3 agents convened in Dewey's office, it developed that Dunce and Church had had better luck than Nye. Brother Nye, as the others called him. Members of the KBI are partial to nicknames. Dunce is known as Old Man, unfairly since he is not quite 50, a burly but light-footed man with a broad tomcat face, and Church, who is 60 or so, pink-skinned and professorial-looking, but tough, according to his colleagues, and the fastest draw in Kansas, is called Curly because his head is partly hairless. Both men, in the course of their inquiries, had picked up promising leads. Dunce's story concerned a father and son who shall here be known as John Sr. and John Jr. Some years earlier, John Sr. had conducted with Mr. Clutter a minor business transaction, the outcome of which angered John Sr., who felt that clutter had thrown him a queer ball. Now, both John Sr. and his son boozed. Indeed, John Jr. was an often incarcerated alcoholic. One unfortunate day, father and son, full of whiskey courage, appeared at the Clutter home intending to have it out with Herb. They were denied the chance, for Mr. Clutter, an abstainer aggressively opposed to drink and drunkards, seized a gun and marched them off his property. This discourtesy the Johns had not forgiven. As recently as a month ago, John Sr. had told an acquaintance, "Every time I think of that bastard, my hands start to twitch. I just want to choke him." Church's lead was of a similar nature. He, too, had heard of someone admittedly hostile to Mr. Clutter, a certain Mr. Smith, though that is not his true name, who believed that the squire of River Valley Farm had shot and killed Smith's hunting dog. Church had inspected Smith's farm home and seen there, hanging from a barn rafter, a length of rope tied with the same kind of knot that was used to bind the four Clutters. Dewey said, "One of those. Maybe that's our deal. A personal thing. A grudge that got out of hand." "Unless it was robbery," said Nye, though robbery as the motive had been much discussed and then more or less dismissed. The arguments against it were good, the strongest being that Mr. Clutter's aversion to cash was a county legend. He had no safe and never carried large sums of money. Also, if robbery were the explanation, why hadn't the robber removed the jewelry that Mrs. Clutter was wearing? A gold wedding band and a diamond ring. Yet Nye was not convinced. "The whole setup has that robbery smell. What about Clutter's wallet? Someone left it open and empty on Clutter's bed. I don't think it was the owner." "And Nancy's purse. The purse was lying on the kitchen floor. How did it get there?" "Yes, and not a dime in the house." "Well, $2. We found $2 in an envelope on Nancy's desk. And we know Clutter cashed a check for $60 just the day before. We figure there ought to have been at least 50 of that left. So some say nobody would kill four people for $50. And say, sure, maybe the killer did take the money, but just to try and mislead us, make us think robbery was the reason. I wonder." As darkness fell, Dewey interrupted the consultation to telephone his wife, Marie, at their home and warn her that he wouldn't be home for dinner. She said, "Yes." "All right, Alvin." But he noticed in her tone an uncharacteristic anxiety. The Deweys, parents of two young boys, had been married 17 years, and Marie, a Louisiana-born former FBI stenographer whom he'd met while he was stationed in New Orleans, sympathized with the hardships of his profession. The eccentric hours, the sudden calls summoning him to distant areas of the state. He said, "Anything the matter?" "Not a thing," she assured him. "Only, when you come home tonight, you'll have to ring the bell. I've had all the locks changed." Now he understood and said, "Don't worry, honey. Just lock the doors and turn on the porch light." After he'd hung up, a colleague asked, "What's wrong? Marie scared?" "Hell yes," Dewey said. "Her and everybody else." Not everybody. Certainly not Holcomb's widowed postmistress, the intrepid Mrs. Myrtle Clare, who scorned her fellow townsmen as a lily-livered lot, shaken in their boots, afraid to shut their eyes, and said of herself, "This old girl, she's sleeping good as ever. Anybody wants to play a trick on me, let 'em try." 11 months later, a gun-toting team of masked bandits took her at her word by invading the post office and relieving the lady of $950. As usual, Mrs. Clare's notions conformed with those of very few. "Around here," according to the proprietor of one Garden City hardware store, "locks and bolts are the fastest-going item. Folks ain't particular what brand they buy. They just want them to hold." Imagination, of course, can open any door. turn the key and let terror walk right in. Tuesday, at dawn, a carload of pheasant hunters from Colorado, strangers, ignorant of the local disaster, were startled by what they saw as they crossed the prairies and passed through Holcomb. Windows ablaze, almost every window in almost every house, and in the brightly lit rooms, fully clothed people, even entire families, who had sat the whole night wide awake, watchful, listening. Of what were they frightened? It might happen again. That, with variations, was the customary response. However, one woman, a schoolteacher, observed, "Feeling wouldn't run half so high if this had happened to anyone except the Clutters. Anyone less admired, prosperous, secure. But that family represented everything people hereabouts really value and respect, and that such a thing could happen to them? Well, it's like being told there is no God. It makes life seem pointless. I don't think people are so much frightened as they are deeply depressed." Another reason, the simplest, the ugliest, was that this hitherto peaceful congregation of neighbors and old friends had suddenly to endure the unique experience of distrusting each other. Understandably, they believed that the murderer was among themselves, and, to the last man, endorsed an opinion advanced by Arthur Clutter, a brother of the deceased, who, while talking to journalists in the lobby of a Garden City hotel on November 17th, had said, "When this is cleared up, I'll wager whoever did it was someone within 10 miles of where we now stand." Approximately 400 miles east of where Arthur Clutter then stood, two young men were sharing a booth in the Eagle Buffet, a Kansas City diner. One, narrow-faced and with a blue cat tattooed on his right hand, had polished off several chicken salad sandwiches and was now eyeing his companion's meal, an untouched hamburger and a glass of root beer in which 3 aspirin were dissolving. "Perry, baby," Dick said. "You don't want that burger. I'll take it." Perry shoved the plate across the table. "Christ! Can't you let me concentrate?" "You don't have to read it 50 times. The reference was to a front-page article in the November 17th edition of the Kansas City Star. Headlined, "Clues Are Few in Slaying of Four," the article, which was a follow-up of the previous day's initial announcement of the murders, ended with a summarizing paragraph. "The investigators are left faced with a search for a killer or killers whose cunning is apparent if his or their motive is not. For this killer or killers, carefully cut the telephone cords of the home's 2 telephones, bound and gagged their victims expertly with no evidence of a struggle with any of them. Left nothing in the house amiss, left no indication they had searched for anything with the possible exception of Clutter's billfold. Shot 4 persons in different parts of the house, calmly picking up the expended shotgun shells. Arrived and left the home, presumably with the murder weapon, without being seen. Acted without a motive, if you care to discount an abortive robbery attempt, which the investigators are wont to do." "For this killer or killers," said Perry, reading aloud. "That's incorrect. The grammar is. It ought to be, for this killer or these killers." Sipping his aspirin-spiked root beer, he went on, "Anyway, I don't believe it. Neither do you. Own up, Dick. Be honest. You don't believe this no-clue stuff." Yesterday, after studying the papers, Perry had put the same question, and Dick, who thought he'd disposed of it, "Look, if those cowboys could make the slightest connection, we'd have heard the sounds of hoofs 100 miles off," was bored at hearing it again. Too bored to protest when Perry once more pursued the matter. "I've always played my hunches. That's why I'm alive today. You know Willie J.? He said I was a natural-born medium, and he knew about things like that. He was interested. He said I had a high degree of extrasensory perception, sort of like having built-in radar. You see things before you see them. The outlines of coming events. Take, like, my brother and his wife. Jimmy and his wife. They were crazy about each other. But he was jealous as hell, and he made her so miserable, being jealous and always thinking she was passing it out behind his back, that she shot herself. And the next day, Jimmy put a bullet through his head. When it happened, this was 1949, and I was in Alaska with Dad up around Circle City. I told Dad, Jimmy's dead. A week later, we got the news. Lord's truth. Another time, over in Japan, I was helping load a ship, and I sat down to rest a minute. Suddenly, a voice inside me said, jump. I jumped, I guess, maybe 10 feet, and just then, right where I'd been sitting, a ton of stuff came crashing down. I could give you 100 examples. I don't care if you believe me or not. For instance, right before I had my motorcycle accident, I saw the whole thing happen. Saw it in my mind. The rain, the skid tracks, me lying there bleeding and my legs broken. That's what I've got now. A premonition. Something tells me this is a trap. He tapped the newspaper. A lot of prevarications. Dick ordered another hamburger. During the past few days, he'd known a hunger that nothing. 3 successive steaks, 12 Hershey bars, 1 pound of gumdrops seemed to interrupt. Perry, on the other hand, was without appetite. He subsisted on root beer, aspirin, and cigarettes. No wonder you got leaps, Dick told him. Ah, come on, baby. Get the bubbles out of your blood. We scored. It was perfect. I'm surprised to hear that, all things considered, Perry said. The quietness of his tone italicized the malice of his reply. But Dick took it, even smiled, and his smile was a skillful proposition. Here, it said, wearing a kid grin, was a very personable character. Clean cut, affable, a fellow any man might trust to shave him. Okay, Dick said. Maybe I had some wrong information. Hallelujah. But on the whole, it was perfect. We hit the ball right out of the park. It's lost, and it's gonna stay lost. There isn't a single connection. I can think of one. Perry had gone too far. He went further. Floyd. Is that the name? A bit below the belt, but then Dick deserved it. His confidence was like a kite that needed reeling in. Nevertheless, Perry observed with some misgiving the symptoms of fury rearranging Dick's expression. Jaw, lips, the whole face slackened. Saliva bubbles appeared at the corners of his mouth. Well, if it came to a fight, Perry could defend himself. He was short, several inches shorter than Dick, and his runty, damaged legs were unreliable, but he outweighed his friend, was thicker, had arms that could squeeze the breath out of a bear. To prove it, however, have a fight, a real falling out, was far from desirable. Like Dick or not, and he didn't dislike Dick, though once he'd liked him better, respected him more, it was obvious they could not now safely separate. On that point, they were in accord, for Dick had said, "If we get caught, let's get caught together. Then we can back each other up. When they start pulling the confession crap, saying you said and I said." Moreover, if he broke with Dick, it meant the end of plans still attractive to Perry, and still, despite recent reverses, deemed possible by both. A skin-diving, treasure-hunting life lived together among islands or along coasts south of the border. Dick said, "Mr. Wells." He picked up a fork. "It'd be worth it. Like if I was nabbed on a check charge, it'd be worth it. Just to get back in there." The fork came down and stabbed the table. "Right through the heart, honey." "I'm not saying he would," said Perry, willing to make a concession now that Dick's anger had soared past him and struck elsewhere. He'd be too scared. Sure, said Dick. Sure. He'd be too scared. A marvel, really, the ease with which Dick negotiated changes of mood. In a trice, all trace of meanness, of sullen bravura, had evaporated. He said, about that premonition stuff. Tell me this. If you were so damn sure you were gonna crack up, why didn't you call it quits? It wouldn't have happened if you'd stayed off your bike, right? That was a riddle that Perry had pondered. He felt he'd solved it, but the solution, while simple, was also somewhat hazy. No. Because once a thing is set to happen, all you can do is hope it won't. Or will, depending. As long as you live, there's always something waiting. And even if it's bad, and you know it's bad, what can you do? You can't stop living. Like my dream. Since I was a kid, I've had this same dream. Where I'm in Africa. A jungle. I'm moving through the trees toward a tree standing all alone. Jesus, it smells bad, that tree. It kind of makes me sick the way it stinks. Only, it's beautiful to look at. It has blue leaves and diamonds hanging everywhere. Diamonds like oranges. That's why I'm there. To pick myself a bushel of diamonds. But I know the minute I try to, the minute I reach up, a snake is gonna fall on me. A snake that guards the tree. This fat son of a bitch living in the branches. I know this beforehand, see? And Jesus, I don't know how to fight a snake. But I figure, well, I'll take my chances. What it comes down to is I want the diamonds more than I'm afraid of the snake. So I go to pick one. I have the diamond in my hand. I'm pulling at it when the snake lands on top of me. We wrestle around, but he's a slippery son of a bitch and I can't get a hold. He's crushing me. You can hear my legs cracking. Now comes the part it makes me sweat even to think about. See, he starts to swallow me. Feet first. Like going down in quicksand. Perry hesitated. He could not help noticing that Dick, busy gouging under his fingernails with a fork prong, was uninterested in his dream. Dick said, "So? The snake swallows you, or what?" "Never mind. It's not important." But it was. The finale was of great importance, a source of private joy. He'd once told it to his friend Willie J. He had described to him the towering bird, the yellow sort of parrot. Of course, Willie J. was different. Delicate-minded, a saint. He'd understood. But Dick? Dick might laugh. And that Perry could not abide. Anyone's ridiculing the parrot, which had first flown into his dreams when he was 7 years old. A hated, hating half-breed child living in a California orphanage run by nuns. Shrouded disciplinarians who whipped him for wetting his bed. It was after one of these beatings, one he could never forget. She woke me up. She had a flashlight and she hit me with it. Hit me and hit me. And when the flashlight broke, she went on hitting me in the dark. That the parrot appeared, arrived while he slept, a bird taller than Jesus, yellow like a sunflower, a warrior angel who blinded the nuns with its beak, fed upon their eyes, slaughtered them as they pleaded for mercy, then so gently lifted him, enfolded him, winged him away to paradise. As the years went by, the particular torments from which the bird delivered him altered. Others, older children, his father, a faithless girl, a sergeant he'd known in the army, replaced the nuns, but the parrot remained a hovering avenger. Thus, the snake, that custodian of the diamond-bearing tree, never finished devouring him, but was itself always devoured. And afterward, the blessed ascent. Ascension to a paradise that in one version was merely a feeling, a sense of power, of unassailable superiority. sensations that in another version were transposed into a real place, like out of a movie.